Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for The Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That is, of course, the theme music to one of the most popular game shows in television history, Jeopardy. And on The Morning Show today, we have a special treat for you. We're going to be replaying a conversation that was first recorded way back in January of 2001 with Brian Lynch, a man from Kenosha who works for the Barbershop Harmony Society. And some of you may also know Brian Lynch if you have attended Ye Olde English Christmas Feast, where he has performed as Lord High Chamberlain since 2001. On this Morning Show conversation, I had the chance to talk with Brian Lynch a couple of days after his particular episode of Jeopardy aired, and it was such fun to be taken behind the scenes of this game show and to find out more about Brian's experience. Here is that conversation, again from January of 2001. And we welcome you to The Morning Show on WGTD-FM 91.1. And I am so pleased to have in the studio today Brian Lynch, who is on the staff at Harmony Hall, the world headquarters for the Society for the Preservation and Encouragement of Barbershop Quartet Singing in America. And he is the e-business strategist there at Harmony Hall. And we'll find out briefly what that's all about, but then we'll proceed to the primary matter at hand, which is talking to Brian Lynch about the extraordinary experience of appearing on one of America's most popular game shows, Jeopardy, as a contestant. And it was a week ago tomorrow, I think.
Correct, Wednesday the 10th.
That television viewers across the country, and I'm sure many, many of them right here in southeastern Wisconsin, were watching in the mid-afternoon, watching Brian Lynch's appearance on Jeopardy. So that's what we're going to get to in just a little bit. Brian Lynch, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks for having me. It's really exciting.
Well, we're glad that you can be here. I don't know if this will be as exciting as being on Jeopardy, but we'll do our best. First of all, let's find out just a little bit about what you do at Harmony Hall. You've been there for a few years, and how long?
9 years now, 9.5 years.
Wow, time flies.
Sure does.
And tell us a little bit about this position of being an e-business strategist, of all things.
Well, it's a pretty grandiose title for what is a pretty large job, we hope. I've been at Harmony Hall since 1991, and I came here as a writer and a public relations guy, which I've done for the last 9 years. And over about the last year or so, we've discovered that our organization increasingly is relying on the World Wide Web for doing our business processes and doing our communication with our members and our education and things like that. It's something that's been kind of homebrew with Scott Hogue, our IT manager, and myself, and we've just discovered that we can't afford to not devote more time to developing it for our 34,000 members. So I'll be looking into how to integrate our e-commerce with our collaboration with our business processes and things like that. Mm. Neat job.
Yeah. Well, I suppose with an organization that is as international in scope as the society is, you really have to be thinking in those kind of terms in everything you do, including how you
Absolutely.
Communicate with one another.
Absolutely. Because in addition to 34,000 members in the United States and Canada, there are probably another 40,000 barbershop-style singers around the world in affiliated organizations with ours, in the Sweet Adelines International, in Harmony Incorporated, another women's organization. And we are a primary supplier of education services to all those groups, and we're trying to find ways to make barbershop more accessible to everybody.
Terrific. Well, you certainly made a good case for barbershop appearing on this national game show. We're going to talk about that in a little bit, and I see you're wearing the same barbershop quartet tie that you wore on the show. So was that an edict from Daryl Flynn that you have to do the barbershop thing?
Good night.
Well, very good. Let's talk about this experience of appearing on Jeopardy, and I'm really anxious to ask you all kinds of questions. And this is not unprecedented. It's maybe 3 or 4 years ago that a UW Parkside professor, Greg Mayer, appeared on the morning show. Bill Guy talked to him to explore his experience of being a contestant on Jeopardy. And it was just so fun to kind of get a behind-the-scenes peek at how these game shows operate and what it's like to have the great opportunity to be a contestant. Had you been a fan of Jeopardy for a long time?
Yeah, I watched it fairly regularly, and at some points I would, after a while I got interested enough that I would tape it, especially after I found out it was going to be on. And then I was taping it and watching
Whoa.
It every day and, really drilling against it. But, I'd always been a casual fan of it, and like everyone watching a game show, whether it's Jeopardy or Wheel of Fortune or Millionaire or any of those things, I always sat there, banging out the answers, going, "Jeez, I could do this. I'm smarter than that guy."
So you did something about it, unlike most of the rest of us who think those thoughts from the comfort of our easy chair. You decided to actually go for it. First of all, how did you even find out about the opportunity to, you audition for Jeopardy?
Right. My wife was watching the show one day, and at the break, they announced auditions coming up in Chicago, and she said, "Honey, you've got to do this. You could do this." So I thought, well, come on, take a day off work and go down and audition. That's an adventure in itself. So, and in case anyone's interested in trying out for this, the fastest way to check for auditions is to go to Jeopardy.com online. They list all their upcoming audition sites and dates. And you can also travel to L.A. to audition, although that's something you should do only if you're out there.
Yeah, right.
Probably not worth it just for that. But signed up, and they sent me an invitation, and there I went on May 17th or so.
So anybody on the face of the earth can audition for the show in the way that you did. I mean,
yeah,
there's
no
kind of written test that gets you in the door.
Correct. You just basically apply for it. They send you an invitation. And in the case of the Chicago auditions, there are about 300 people there. At one point, I looked around the waiting area and kind of saw people reading books, big, heavy books, Proust and Hegel and
wow.
all these real weighty things. And thinking, another unemployed English major, just
wow.
like me.
Yeah. Now, did you do any kind of prep ahead of that audition?
No.
Just showed up and thought, let's go for it.
Yeah, and that was pretty much my thinking through the entire process, too. Jeopardy is a general knowledge program. You can't cram for it. Like you might if you're on say something focused on sports trivia or Name That Tune or something that's focused topic, you might be able to cram for it, but really Jeopardy encompasses everything from pop culture to literature to history to geography. About the only things I think you could cram for might be geography, because it's a fairly fixed set of knowledge. Although even that's changing. You still look at Europe over the last 20 years.
Yeah, right. So how did this audition work? Was it sort of a mock-up of a show, the show we watch on television, or was it conducted in some other way?
It's in two phases. First is a written phase where they shuffle you into a big conference room in a hotel downtown, sit you down at a table, give you a sheet of paper, and say, "We're going to ask you 50 questions in 50 categories." And they actually do it using a TV monitor with Alex Trebek reading the questions.
Oh,
so it's
really?
Just like being on the show. The difference being you don't have to write down what is, and they come really fast. There are 50 questions in 50 categories in about 8 minutes. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's about right. They come about every 8 seconds.
It is a written test, though.
Yeah,
you are writing the question.
Yeah, what is Queen Elizabeth, and so on.
And so you have to process each question, and then boom, you're on to the next one.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's a great format. I mean, it is, in effect, a written test, but not in the way that most written tests work at all. You don't get to sit there and ponder.
Right. And because Jeopardy is a timed program,
right,
you're against a clock and other people ringing in. They need to know if you can answer quickly. The 50 questions in 50 categories is to make sure that you have breadth of knowledge. Because, again, if someone showed up and, you know, banged out 10 right answers in geography and then was a complete idiot in history, like I am, they don't want someone to show up on the show and be staring like a deer in the headlights. I don't know what to do. And vice versa. They don't want someone who's really good in everything else to bomb out on the audition because he couldn't get one category.
Yeah, interesting. So did you get a score at the end of that?
No, they said that everyone who gets 70% or greater would continue on to the next round. The official word is, Alex Trebek told me that I just missed it by one. For the people who didn't make the cut. So I turn that around and think, I made it by just one question.
But you made it.
Yeah.
And so what did that mean then?
From that point, about 70 people who were in the room in my session, they broke it out over four or five sessions over 2 days. The 70 people in the room were winnowed down to about 17, 18. And those 18 subsequently go through a mock game where they have, you know, clickers up there and someone reading the cards and so on. And they have everyone ask, you know, answer a couple of questions. I'm not sure that the clickers were actually active, that they were actually, you know, locking each other out. I think the important thing was really that they wanted to make sure everyone had a chance to talk, to answer a few questions, to ask, you know, ask for a few categories, and then subsequently to do the chit-chat section. Because, again, they want people who are going to look comfortable on stage, be able to react naturally, be able to talk about themselves and about their hobbies and things.
Yeah. I suppose that also helps them make sure that you're somebody who has decent vision, and not just that you have, I mean, 20/20 vision or something that approximates it, but that you can look and see a question and process it that way. And so, I mean, not everybody can really function well in that kind of a setting. And so I suppose they have to test for all kinds of things we never think about.
Yeah.
How did they winnow down from 70 to 17 or 18?
The basis of that test.
Oh, that's where that happened.
The written test takes you to the next round of the 17 people.
I see. Gotcha. Right. So from that, how many people were selected?
We don't know. You really don't know. That just, all they tell you at that point is, well, we'll put you all on file now, and we will contact you before your show. Our taping season runs from August 1st to May 31st or something like that, and we'll let you know.
Now, does that mean all of them at some point are destined to be on the program, or they have no way of knowing?
They're not real specific on that.
Really?
And I think it's in part because they don't want to... They don't want to be too abrupt with anyone and saying, you really knew a lot of the answers, but we don't think your personality is going to work. There was one gentleman at the audition who kind of befriended me afterwards and said, well, you know, this is the third time I've been to the audition and I've gotten to this point, so I'm sure they're going to call me this year. And my guess was that some of his personal presentation was keeping them from asking him. He was a little awkward and a little stiff, and I think he probably knew a lot of the material, but was probably not going to be asked. And I think that's why they don't tell you if you passed or not. They would rather just ask you or not ask you.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's kind of sad, I suppose, because, I mean, I think it saddens me maybe a little bit in the sense that we think of Jeopardy as a very serious program, unlike, you know, many other game shows on television where knowledge is rewarded and so on. But they are affected by the same thing as other shows are as well, where they want to, you know, they hope they get a contestant that'll jump up and down and hug Bob Barker and, you know, will fall in love with them. And
now, this is just a guess. I don't know that for sure. This is conjecture, and I wouldn't want to cast any aspirations.
Understood. But it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah.
I mean, Jeopardy for all it is, and obviously it may be the most serious game show on television, but it's on television.
Yeah.
That right there.
Still showbiz.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting. We're talking to Brian Lynch, who works at Harmony Hall, the world headquarters of the Barbershop Harmony Society. But we're talking about his experience as a contestant on Jeopardy. His appearance aired last Wednesday. So, Brian, when did the phone call come?
It came at about the least convenient time possible, the first week of October, when I was wrapped up in a lot of work projects, including beginning this new position, and I only had about 3 weeks before the air date. When they called and said, we'd like to come out, like to have you come out on November 1st, I said, really? I have to do a major presentation to my board of directors the next day. That would really not be a good day. I said, well, we can't guarantee we'd have a slot open for you again. I said, well, that'll be fine. I'll be there November 1st.
Oh.
Yeah, you don't miss a shot like this.
Well, I've always kind of wondered how that works, if they kind of expect people to drop everything they're doing and just appear.
They do it because they can.
Yeah.
You know, as with so many things, there's enough leverage of the fame of the show that people will do a lot of weird things for it.
Right. Well, including buying a plane ticket, from what
I
understand.
Right.
You're responsible for getting yourself out there.
Right.
Do they provide you anything? I mean, do they put you up?
Get a discount at the hotel. That's about it.
Wow. Yeah. So you really have to be devoted to this show and really want the opportunity badly.
But, you know, again, it's an adventure. And it wasn't, you know, a plane ticket to L.A. with enough advances, a couple $100s, and that's not peanuts, but it's one of those things that you can't buy otherwise.
Right.
You can't buy the experience of being on Jeopardy except for actually going and doing it.
Exactly. So you had 3 weeks to think about this. You mentioned earlier that you actually sat down and really watched this show with a different kind of intensity.
Almost. I did for 1 week, and the second week my VCR broke. I programmed it wrong, and I come home at the end of a week thinking, okay, I got a week's worth to watch. I'll really cram on these things, and I get Ricky Lake over and over.
Of all things, I can't think of anything that would prepare you less for being on Jeopardy. Oh boy. But, I mean, you were literally using it as some kind of a prep thing.
Yeah, mostly trying to watch some of the strategies that that the players were using in terms of the timing, what categories they'd take, how they bet, a little bit in how the questions are structured. There, if you look at the questions on Jeopardy, you'll see that there are usually two ways to get to the answer in each clue. There's usually one part of the clue will refine the clue a little more so that you can choose among two near misses. There are usually two elements in each one of them that'll make sure that you can get to precisely the answer. I'm trying to think of a good example now, and it's not coming to mind. Trust me.
Oh, I believe you. You were there. I mean, that's the thing that really intrigues me, among other things, is the I mean, millions of us watch Jeopardy without any serious thought given to ever being on that show. And it must really be interesting for you to watch it now as someone who's been up there.
Oh, yeah.
But also in that three-week window, watching that show thinking, I'm going to be there at some point very soon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was stunning. And now actually looking at the tape, I look back at it and see myself standing at podium number three thinking, the show and the board.
really. When you showed up, as you recount in your journal, which we're going to talk about before we're done, you mentioned purchasing a certain book to sort of aid in the preparation. Tell us about that.
Late in the game, I realized somebody's probably written a book about this. So I looked on Amazon and found a book that was out of print that I couldn't get. Called How to Get on Jeopardy and Win by Michael Dupay. Michael was a Tournament of Champions winner in 1996, which means not only was he a five-day champion, you know, in the regular series, but then when they bring all those champions together, he beat all of them, too. So he was some serious stuff.
So this is the Michael Jordan of Jeopardy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And he put together a book that outlined his strategies, some backstage stuff on how to handle the buzzer, how to handle yourself when you get there, some sample questions and a little bit, you know, some outlines of the kinds of questions they ask and why, and, you know, 15 things you need to know about literature and 15 things you need to know about geography and so on, just to get a sense of how the questions are usually structured. He was serious about it. I mean, he said from the beginning, from the first day he thought, I'd like to be on Jeopardy, that he was methodical in his preparation. And interestingly enough, he got to the end of it and said, I thought this was just about the show, but what I really discovered is that I've exposed myself to the entire breadth of human knowledge. I wasn't quite that in depth.
You brushed up on your state capitals.
My state capital. That's funny because that was the one thing I did study, and I used the Animaniacs state capital song.
Oh,
to do it.
There you go. That's a great. That's great. That's a classic. So you get there, and you are thrown together with a whole bunch of other prospective contestants. How many in all?
There are about 13 people on site that day. Now, Jeopardy! Airs 5 days a week. They actually tape 5 shows a day on Tuesday and on Wednesday.
Oh.
So that gives them a lot of flexibility in their schedule, obviously. It allows them to have production breaks. It allows them to tear down the set in Culver City and take it out to locations where they're doing tournaments and Tournament of Champions and things like that. And, of course, it's just economically a lot cheaper to shoot 5 in a day, 5 back-to-back. So I was on Wednesday, the second of 2 days in that week, and they have 10 to 13 people on hand each day. A couple of those people will be from California, local people who've won local auditions, with the idea that they can do all the out-of-towners, and if they don't need the California residents, they can send them home and not have, you know, drag them across the country to sit and watch instead of
right.
play.
So you know it's going to happen then and there.
Yeah, they don't guarantee it. They leave themselves a little wiggle room, but it's real likely.
Yeah, and I remember one of the points you made with Dave McGrath in his excellent report with you is that you really don't know which game you're going to be playing in until really just before it happens.
That's right. They will tape a show. There will be about 15 or 20 minutes between shows. Well, they reset the tape, and Alex Trebek changes costume. And during that time, the champion goes backstage and gets dressed. And as he's walking off, the production assistants walk up and with a hat, literally a hat in their hand, and reach in and say, "For our next game, Brian, would you join us at podium 3? And Jolynn, would you join us at podium 2? I mean, that's the time you have. You stand up, you walk backstage, brush your hair again, get a drink of water. Walk on stage, you're ready to play.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're going to pick up the story at that point in just a minute or two with Brian Lynch, who was a contestant on Jeopardy. His appearance aired last week, and we're about to get to the moment of truth. We're spinning quite a story here of what it's like to appear as a contestant on Jeopardy, which, of course, is one of the most popular and certainly one of the most acclaimed television game shows in recent years. Brian and I were talking before tape ran today that we both remember watching Jeopardy way back when, in the days of Art Fleming, when it wasn't all electronic and glitzy, but very much the show that millions of Americans enjoy on a daily basis. So your name literally drawn out of a hat, and you're paired with Jolynn and a defending champion by the name of Michael. One of the things that you talk about in your journal about Jeopardy is how as you watch the games ahead of you being played, you very quickly spot those very formidable prospective opponents that I mean, every bit as scary as Michael Jordan would be on the basketball court, right?
Very, very much. In fact, when I arrived on the studio lot, you get there under your own means. There's a shuttle bus from the hotel I was at, because, of course, a lot of tourists will go, you know, tour the studio, too. You go and sit on a little bench that says Jeopardy Contestants, right next to the one that says Wheel of Fortune Contestants, isn't it?
Really?
Yeah. And this little tram comes by and picks you up. But, you know, people kind of trickle in, the contestants who are going to be on that day, and they're all kind of eyeing each other, kind of sizing each other up. You know, some people are chatting and are real friendly, and some people are real focused and so on. One guy had a stack of books that he was reading, and I thought, well, great, you can really cram right now. Well, it turns out he was already a 4-day champion who was returning, so I was like, okay,
oh.
I guess it couldn't hurt, right? He subsequently lost in that second game.
Was that Adam?
Adam, right. And he was a machine. The guy who beat him, Michael, was... Had a personal bearing that was very aggressive, very, very strong, and he had that air of, I'm going to beat you. And, you know, I'm kind of chit-chatting with people because I'm a fairly gregarious guy, and I kind of get this vibe from him, like, well, you are tough, aren't you? Turns out he was. Very tough.
The bite was as worse, as bad as the bark.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah.
So, you, names drawn out of a hat. You've seen this Michael already in action.
Yep, he'd already beaten the champ, the current champ.
So that had to be scary right then and there.
Oh, yeah. And, of course, we're all sitting together. All the contestants are sitting together in one section of the audience watching these games. And after Adam won his first game, everyone looked around like, who wants to play him? And then Michael beats him like, oh, great. Who wants to beat him?
Right. Because he appears to be perhaps even a stronger player.
Right.
So it's kind of a dubious honor for your name to be drawn out of the hat at that moment. Did you know the woman, Jo Lynn, that was a contestant with you?
I hadn't had much of a chance to chat with her. When we get to the studio, they take us down to the green room, and which isn't green, of course, and take us through the paperwork, explain what's going to happen, how the day's going to go, put us in makeup, just a little light, you know, powder and stuff to keep the glare off. And there's some slack time there where we get a chat. And I had actually kind of made friends with someone. Who's a Vivian Moyle, who is an anatomy teacher at Northwestern University. I mean, pounding big brain. Pounding big brain. But I hadn't had a chance to talk with Jo Lynn. Vivian played the game before mine and was just crushed. Absolutely crushed by those two others.
Adam and Michael.
Adam and Michael, yeah.
That's right. I think you said she didn't even get to play Final Jeopardy.
That's right.
I always hate that moment when that happens.
Yeah, that's so tough. It's so tough to see a contestant in that position.
Well, and as you as a contestant, hope to high heaven that you're not going to be in that same position.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, you look around the room and you're talking to people who are every bit as smart as you are, clearly, because here they are. And you're talking about your careers and so on, and you know, anatomy professor at Northwestern. Oh, my God, this is a smart person. What am I doing here?
Yeah, well, I work for the Barbershop Society. Right. Huh, interesting. That has to, I suppose a lot of this is about poise, keeping your cool.
Yeah, it is a lot about it. And especially, you know, I've been thrilled with you know, the thanks and congratulations I've gotten from friends and family and coworkers and people I don't know who saw me on the show. And it's kind of humbling because I don't feel like I'm smart. I feel like this is something I can do.
Like this is a skill, you mean, to do well on Jeopardy. I mean, it calls on specific skills and talents.
Tidbits of knowledge combined with speed of recall. Mm. It doesn't make you smarter. It just means you can do that one thing.
You can pull up these things without sitting there ruminating a long time.
Right, exactly.
So you have to be quick of finger, too. Tell us about the process of just getting the mechanic of that troublesome buzzer underway that some people seem to really have trouble with.
It is tricky, and that's one important lesson I learned from Michael Dupay's book, How to Win on Jeopardy. The buzzer is a combination of technology and old-fashioned human power. What happens, Alex reads a question, a production assistant off stage then presses a button which activates the board. And you can't ring in before the board is active. If you do, there's a half-second lockout, and it takes a half-second before you can hit the buzzer again. So if you punch too early, you're locked out, and you can't punch in again, and you miss your chance to answer the question. Now, when you watch the program, and typically you'll see this before Double Jeopardy begins, when there's a long shot that pulls into the board, you'll see that along either side of the game board there are wooden panels, you know, on the wall that it's set into. At the center of each of those panels, and it's really hard to see on TV, is just a tiny hole, and there's a pinpoint spotlight behind that. So when the production assistant pushes a button and activates the board, those lights go on. We, the contestants, can see that and know that it's ready to buzz in. Now, practically speaking, you can listen to Alex yourself and kind of cue when he's going to, you know, finish reading it and anticipate it and buzz it. So, you know, that human element of the production assistant activating the board has an impact.
Wow.
He can get tired or lose his timing and so on. If you rely on just the lights, you may be too late. If you rely on the voice, you may be too early. So,
well, and plus, where do you put your focus? I mean, you want, obviously, to be paying primarily attention to the question that you have to answer and not be watching lights and,
right.
and thinking, listening to voice inflection too much, and yet you have to. That's one of the realities of the game is buzzing in first.
Absolutely. In fact, Dupay talks about that as a strategy. He says, read the question, get an answer, and then focus on the last word. And that's real important. Focus yourself on his last on the last word in the question so you can be ready to buzz. You can usually see the lights, you know, kind of peripheral vision. We'll kind of pick that up.
When you watch the show, it seems to me that so much of it is rhythm. And you'll see points where somebody is just has the rhythm and they are buzzing in first consistently. Mm-hmm. And you'll see maybe the contestant right next to them or two down is right behind them and perhaps not thinking of the answer late, but for whatever reason, just not buzzing in with the same efficiency.
Exactly. I did a little number crunching. I had to because I'm a geek.
Sure.
And found out that in the first round, Michael actually had 11 right for 3,400 and 2 wrong for 300. He netted 3,100 in the first round. And I had 13 right and 3 wrong in the first round for 2,500. But it was in the second round that he really got it, where he had 12 right for 8,800 and 3 wrong for 2,800. And I had only 6 right for 3,800, only 200 points in one wrong answer. But he answered twice as many questions in that second round because I lost that rhythm on the buzzer. I was right behind him, and there's a point, you don't see it in the tape, where I'm like pointing out, like, what's wrong with this thing?
What's wrong with this crazy thing?
Well,
I've seen that happen before. In fact, once in a while, you'll even hear a contestant kind of have an outburst of some kind, like, this can't be working right, but you're not working right.
Yeah, exactly. It's really frustrating.
We haven't even really talked about Alex Trebek yet. You indicate that the contestants essentially have little or no contact with him ahead of the actual playing of the game.
Absolutely.
And what's the point of that?
Well, they're very conscientious about avoiding any hint of favoritism, of any scandal, of any opportunity that the players have advanced knowledge of the questions or anything like that. Again, responding to the quiz show scandals of the 50s, really. So everywhere you go on the set, between the green room and the set and the audience, you are ushered around by the production staff. They never let you anywhere near the writers, the judges, the Alex, any of that. They want to make sure that you are absolutely contained and that there's no chance that there will be any impropriety.
Wow.
When Alex reads those cue cards with your personal bio and things like that, he's essentially talking to you for the first time. He's probably reviewed them in advance, but this is the first time he's ever talked to you about it. So that's very real. It's very genuine.
Interesting. What did he make of S-P-E-B-S-Q-S-A?
Pretty good botch, really. He got the letters right, and he said, I don't even know what this means. Of course, I was stunned. As a PR guy, I was stunned that I hadn't reached him with my message. But
yeah, right.
But I got to tell him what it was about. And
tell us what you did in that little bit of banter, which, if I recall correctly, didn't actually make it on the air.
It actually was cut for time, I think. I did, get in the line that we're 34,000 guys who love to sing. And then he asked me about a couple of songs and said, well, yeah, actually, I do know a couple of songs. In fact, I thought you might want to sing. So I brought my pitch pipe along, and I picked up my pitch pipe and blew the pitch. And they cut that, which kind of hurt. I was really hoping that would hit.
Too bad, because that banter is usually the most boring part of the show, and you livened it up a little bit.
A little bit.
Well, let's get to the game itself with formidable Michael and Jolynn and you. As you made your way up to those three positions, were the three of you talking very much, or what was sort of the game face being put on by each of you?
There wasn't a lot of conversation among us, except nodhead, good luck, sportsmanlike kind of smiles and so on. They wire you up. They don't actually have a mic on you. Show you your position, show you how to use the light pen that you write your name with and so on. And again, just kind of walk you through what happens. During all the breaks, too, the production assistants come out and will, give you a drink of water if you want, straighten your tie, anything like that. Just to, and in some cases, actually give you a little strategy. And just a tiny bit, saying, if nothing else, a pat on the back, or say, you're doing great, stay with the buzzer, you're doing great. Jolynn's case, she was getting both locked out on the buzzer, and she just had some unfortunate answers and was going backwards a lot of the time.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, and on national television. Yeah. I mean, it's one thing if you're sitting in the privacy of your living room and you don't know any of these answers, but it's another to be doing it in front of millions of viewers. You just got to feel for somebody like that. I suppose one of the really important moments is when those categories go up on the board, because that can sink you right there.
Oh, it sure can. And I got really lucky. I got mostly categories I knew something about or could guess my way through. I didn't have any real black holes. I was weak in questions about Akron, Ohio. Gee, I don't know why. There was one category called Scandalous Women that Jolynn did very well in. And DuPay had talked about that in his book and noted that Jeopardy's made a conscious effort to include more categories discussing women.
Mm.
And interestingly enough, she ran that one. She was cooking right along on that one.
Interesting. I'm trying to remember if there were any musically related categories in Jeopardy or Double Jeopardy.
There was one kind of close. There were two of them. One was... I just forgot. Oh, the Gershwin one was in another show. There was one called If I Were a Musical, which was kind of cute.
Oh,
it was basically just a pun kind of thing. If it were a musical, one of the production numbers would be, why'd you have to go and shoot the albatross? You know, the musical version of Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, some pretty silly ones like that. But, no, nothing directly musical.
And nothing directly barbershop, needless
to
say.
No, they're a little thin on the barbershop.
I suppose that, I mean, when you think about it, you have three contestants, and I suppose it's always possible that there'll be some nuclear physicist up there, and physics will be one of the categories.
Oh, yeah.
And but when you keep everything random, that's just the chance you run, I guess.
One of my friends here in town who's a pastor kind of tweaked me and said, oh, great. You didn't get any of the answers in the Bible, and you got them all in witchcraft. What's wrong with you?
Oh,
I was ringing in. I knew Jonah. I knew that one.
Interesting.
Okay, fine.
As you're playing the game, as, for instance, that first round is going, is your score visible to you? It's certainly visible to us, but can you also see what your score is?
Yes. If you're standing at the podium... Think of the podium as a clock face, you know, the stage as a clock face. Say the podiums are at 6 o'clock, Alex is at 3 o'clock, the game board is at about 1 o'clock, it's a little pitched on an angle,
right.
And then directly in front of you at 12 o'clock is, on the floor, a big screen monitor where you can see the video clues and things like that, and then above that, and actually look up maybe 15 feet, is a big scoreboard where you can see your individual scores, which is why when a player hits a daily double, you'll often see him looking upwards. He's looking up to check the scores and see where he is relative to the other players. So you can see how you're doing. Now, practically speaking, you're busy. You know, you're thinking, and if you're answering questions, you're asking another one. You don't always have time to connect where you are. You don't want to slow down. Because you want to ask as many questions as possible, more opportunities to score.
Absolutely.
So I didn't really know exactly where I stood until I looked up at you know, coming into the end of that first round, like, hey, I'm tied. He pulled ahead by one question at the end of the first round. So it's okay.
But with a formidable opponent like that, that had to make you feel really, really good.
Oh, yeah. I was really surprised. Wow, I'm doing great.
One of the interesting moments is when you hit the daily double.
Mm-hmm.
Which we should explain to people. I mean, I can hardly imagine a public radio listener not listening to Jeopardy, but in case there is such a creature out there, you hit the daily double, and that means that you can set the amount of money that you sort of make a bid of how much, as opposed to it being prescribed by the spot on the board.
Right.
And you hit the daily double.
And the category was witchcraft, which I had already answered two or three questions, and it was feeling pretty good. I was behind at the time, but not by much. And I figured, I'm feeling good. I'm cooking along on the buzzer. I'm going to bet big on this because if I hit it, I would take the lead with a good margin too. So I bet $900, and this is the embarrassing part of the whole show for me, really.
Oh, good. I'm glad we can talk about this
because the clue comes up. This Shakespeare wrote this play in 1606, in part to appeal to King James I's interest in magic. I was an English major in college, and had actually studied Shakespeare, and was feeling pretty clever. I had also just the other day been looking over some of Dupé's clues on 15 things you ought to know about Shakespeare, and a lot of those had centered on the Tempest. And I'm thinking, 1606, magic. Seems a little early for the Tempest, but yeah, that's got to be it. What is the Tempest? Oh, no, I'm sorry. What is Macbeth? The Three Witches. Like, oh, I knew that. So all my friends from college will be telling me for the rest of my life, oh, you really really soaked up a lot in Shakespeare,
yeah,
did you?
Yeah, right. Oh. Well, and I think it's interesting how you have to go right on from there. I mean, you don't get 5 minutes to go off and have a cry. The next question is asked, and I've seen, and I'm sure you have too, more than one occasion where someone really their boat goes on the rocks at that point, and they are really in trouble, terribly distracted, and so on. That didn't seem to be the case with you, I wouldn't say.
No, I think I actually still hit 4 or 5 answers after that in that round. So,
you're probably mad.
By the end of that round, I was still doing pretty well. I was still within $600.
Yeah. So. As you say, the second round did not go quite as well. To what do you attribute that?
Well, a couple of things. I was doing okay on knowing the categories, although it kind of started out with a couple categories I wasn't real strong on. But one thing you don't see on the tape is where they had to stop shooting and back up the tape to get a ruling on a question. It was only fourth or fifth question in that round that Jolynn had hit on a question about B.F. Goodrich.
Oh, the tire company.
The tire guy, yeah. He brought a specific skill to Akron, Ohio that became the basis of its fame. And she answered, what is the galvanization of rubber?
Oh.
And they had to stop and look it up to verify it's not galvanization, it's vulcanization. And I didn't know that either. But you can't see on the tape. They stop the camera, they turn us around, so if the board is activated, we don't see any more clues.
Mm.
And they look it up. Well, that's about a 6-7 minute break while they do that. And when it came back, I'd lost that rhythm that we were talking about. I'd lost that rhythm on the buzzer, so I was knowing the answers, but I couldn't ring in. I was getting beat at the switch every time.
You needed to be like a tennis player, doing the little hip-hop thing and keeping themselves
brain exercises or something.
Something. Oh, interesting. That reminds me, too, you recounted a kind of a moment where there was sort of a stop in the action because of something you did in a special video category.
Right. The category was wordplay, which are like the wuzzles you see in the newspaper every day.
Mm.
You'll see the word effects followed by the. And you have to sort that visual word puzzle out to be the after effects. There's a word clue that goes with it to go with that visual cue. And they had specified at the beginning of the game, you must take these in sequence. You have to start at 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, because that's how the video is queued up.
Mm.
And I was cooking along like, okay, I'm ready to go to word puzzles for 300. Stop the game. Turn around. Oh, I was embarrassed too.
At least a trap door didn't open.
Yeah.
Next. Yeah, right. So we finally get to the finish line with poor Jolynn in negative territory, but you have played actually an admirably close game with Michael. The numbers are big. I'm trying to remember them. I mean, you're in the thousands. 5,000 and 6,000 or something like that?
Yeah, Michael has 7,600 and I have 6,100. And he had racked up a lot of points in that round. He had actually lost 2,800 points in wrong answers in that round, and he was still that far ahead. So, and he was really smoking in that second half.
See, I think it would be so frustrating to be an opponent and feel like you're kind of a spectator in your own game. To just watch someone else kind of taking over. I mean, even if they are answering some of them wrong, it's like, there's where all the action is, two slots down from me.
But I could be at home doing this.
Yeah, right. Well, you get to Final Jeopardy. Your book had told you to, if you're in second place, fairly close, to bet nothing. So that's what
nothing,
you do.
Because you actually get more winning outcomes that way. If you bet at all, and you always assume that the leader's going to bet to win, to beat your doubled score. If you bet at all, there's only one outcome in which the second place person wins. That is, if the leader's wrong and you're right.
Hmm.
That's the only one, the only outcome that you win. If you bet nothing, you win in that outcome, but you also win if he's wrong and you're wrong, because you still have your nut. So that you actually have a better chance of winning by betting zero. So I had that locked in, and one of my college roommates was a statistician and a mathematician, and he had double-checked the game theory on that.
That was a sound way to go.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Of course, he also said, now, he might know you're going to do that, so he might bet you can go.
Exactly. Right.
Up to that.
Yeah.
So I was all ready for it. Like, okay, I'm betting zero. I'm feeling clever. Here we go. Category world records. I got it. And the clue comes up in May of 2000. A Sherpa guide named Babu Chiri did this in record time in just over 16 hours. And we had mentioned before the things we prepared for. I had only prepared two things. One was state capitals, and the other was my wife had told me, "Honey, if there's anything to do with Mount Everest, the answer is Tenzing Norgay." So, I mean, like, the only two things I knew were Tenzing Norgay and Mount Everest. And I'm thinking, well, how many things could there be with a Sherpa, really?
Right.
I mean, Sherpas guide people up Mount Everest. So I was pretty sure that was going to be the answer, climbing Mount Everest. But, and this is the weird part, I wasn't prepared for betting zero and sort of knowing the answer. What should I actually write down? And I thought, well, you know, this would be kind of interesting. It'd be dramatic. It'd be dramatic if I didn't put anything. So they unveil, and he wrote, nothing. Ooh, what's it going to cost you? Nothing. Okay, so that's kind of exciting. I've since found out that it basically means, Brian, you knew everything else. You didn't know Mount Everest. How obvious could that be? So
you're trying to think of the drama of the moment and what's going to make good television.
Exactly, exactly.
Brian.
Brian Lynch was a contestant on Jeopardy back in January of 2001. This is all that is preserved of our morning show conversation, so let me fill you in on a few details. As already mentioned, Brian ended up finishing second with $6,100. He did win a lovely trip to Mexico. Michael, who was already returning champion, won this particular game with $12,600. He won the next game as well, $24,499, quite impressive. And he won two games after that as well. So he was a five-time Jeopardy champion back in the days when that was the limit. You could not compete in more than five consecutive games of Jeopardy. His total winnings for those five victories, $54,499. If you would like to, in a sense, relive this episode of Jeopardy as it played out, or sort of play it yourself, you can go to the Jeopardy Archive, which is j-archive.com, and then look for episode number 3768, and you can see there all of the categories and all of the questions that were played in both rounds of Jeopardy as well as Final Jeopardy. It's a terrific way to explore this particular episode and other episodes that you might want to take a look at. Again, that is j-archive.com. My thanks to Brian Lynch for joining me on The Morning Show here on WGTD. And here's what's coming up next week on The Morning Show. On Monday, I'm very excited to share with you my conversation actually from back in 2008 with Leonard Marcus, an expert on children's literature. The occasion of that conversation was a visit to Carthage where he discussed his then newly published book called Golden Legacy, which was a look at the history of golden books published by Western Publishing in Racine. As you may know, this year marks the 75th anniversary of the first golden books. So that book has been republished, and it's a great opportunity to revisit this really interesting conversation about the history of golden books. That's coming up on Monday's program. On Tuesday, Todd Tucker and his book called Notre Dame versus the Klan. an account of a really interesting actual event that occurred on the campus of Notre Dame back in the 1920s with the Ku Klux Klan. Wednesday, postponed from a couple of weeks ago, the author of a book called Dennis in Iowa, A Discerning Look at Small Town America.